We know this much. The deepening recession isn't just about subprime mortgages. It's not limited to the United States, and it's likely to get worse. Kevin Phillips strikes me as wise and well-informed with a historical perspective and a commitment to the common good. I learned a lot in his newest book, Bad Money, but nothing that might ease our anxiety. In it, he describes the consequences of our misguided economic policies, our mounting debt, our collapsing housing market, our threatened oil, and the end of American domination of world markets. The emergence of a globally dependent U.S. economy dominated by a financial sector rife with extreme risk, debt, deceit, and lack of accountability has failed the American people and pointed the U.S. economy toward a global crisis. And sadly, the debt disaster is a moving train still picking up steam. I hope to ask Phillips why it happened, where we stand, and what we might expect in the days and months ahead. For more than 35 years, Kevin Phillips' insight into American politics and economics has helped to make history as well as record it. His best-selling books, including The Emerging Republican Majority in 1969, The Politics of Rich and Poor in 1990, The American Theocracy in 2006, have influenced political campaigns and changed the way America looks at herself. He's currently a regular contributor to the LA Times, National Public Radio, and writes for Harper's Magazine and Time. We'll focus this time, as I said, on the ideas in his newest book, Bad Money. Welcome again, Kevin Phillips.
Nice to be with you.
Okay, I like listeners to get to know the people behind the ideas. And early on, you were a political strategist for Richard Nixon. We've talked before, when I've had you on, about the evolution in your perspective over the years. But today, could you just share with us how you decided that your best role was outside the political process, more as an observer, a commentator, a historian, rather than as a player?
Well, I think that's sort of a multi-stage transformation, I'd have to say. After the whole crisis of Watergate and Vietnam and the sort of breakdown of American confidence in the 1970s, I really couldn't see myself getting back into electoral politics in any way. I continued to be a Republican. I voted for Reagan twice, but I didn't agree with a number of his policies, particularly in the economic realm. Then the Bushes came along, and that was even harder for me. And by this point, I was drifting away from the Republican Party. Again, particularly on economics, I saw things building up that I didn't like, and actually what's occurring now is probably the consummation of a lot of what I thought was a problem. In 1990, I wrote a book about the weakness of the economic policies under Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and Richard Nixon actually gave me the lead quote on the back of the book jacket. So my evolution, while it was considerable, wasn't out of sync with somebody whose Republican ancestry went back several decades. And I didn't care that much for Bill Clinton, but to me, the absolute worst president to get in this period of crisis was George W. Bush. And we had, my wife and I, by that point, left Washington. I was totally sick of it, and moved to Connecticut. But as these things came together, I found myself drawn back in. And what I did was really much more a combination of history and economics and politics that you didn't have to be in Washington to do. You had to get into the history and the circumstances, and in some respects, a certain amount of detachment was probably a benefit. And this is my fourth book in a series which started in 2002, and they each came during election years, and they each tried to draw a picture that was focused in particular on one major difficulty that was facing the political system. And I think it helped me to be out of Washington to do this, and I've wound up as an independent. I think at this point we probably need a Democrat in the White House, but I'm not so sure I can see how one is going to get there.
Wow. That last comment surprises me. I will tell you, I'm speaking with Kevin Phillips, by the way. I will tell you that I just saw Frank Luntz speak, and he said that he favored and expected Obama to be president. You just said that I can't quote it, but you said you think it might be difficult for them to take back the White House.
Well, you do have this huge division, and I would say that the only thing that probably repairs the division is for Obama and Hillary Clinton to get together. I'm not certain how this would happen. I think Obama seems to still have, I won't say a lock on the nomination, but is the strong favorite. But his former pastor in motion, this fella, he just loves the limelight.
That's exactly right.
There. And he's enjoying that, and Obama is not going to profit from that. There are a lot of things that he was too slow to come to grips with, and that's probably the biggest of them. And even if John McCain doesn't want to use that as an issue, I think that a lot of conservative groups and Republican auxiliaries will.
Yeah, of
and
course.
I think it'll be somewhat effective.
Mm-hmm. I guess we'll see how that one plays out. When we spoke in 2006 about your last book, American Theocracy, as I recall, we dealt very briefly with the religion piece and devoted the bulk of our time to oil and debt. And this book seems to have grown out of those two strands.
Yes, but in turn, those two strands grew out of other things I'd been getting into. One of the centerpieces in American Dynasty in 2004 about the Bush family was how they rose on oil.
Mm-hmm.
And the prominence that oil was occupying, which was ever greater in U.S. politics, and that we had a president and a vice president from the oil industry. So my views on both the debt and the irresponsible finance issue and the oil issue and what it represented, I guess have been coming together across a pretty broad spectrum for a couple of decades. But clearly, this was the decade that accelerated it.
Right. And let me read a quote from you, and then I'll let you just deal with each one of these in turn. This is a quote. "My summation is that American financial capitalism, at a pivotal period in the nation's history, cavalierly ventured a multiple gamble. First, financializing a hitherto more diversified U.S. economy. Second, using massive quantities of debt and leverage to do so. Third, following a stock market bubble with an even larger housing and mortgage bubble. Fourth, roughly quadrupling U.S. credit market debt between 87 and 2007. And fifth, consummating these events with a mixed fireworks of dishonesty, incompetence, and quantitative negligence." First, this point that you make, which I have to admit was new to me, was the financializing of the U.S. economy, the shift from, as the dominant player in the American economy being making things or even serving people into moving money around.
Well, I think that's right, and that's a central part of what's gone wrong. If you go back and you look at the 1970s, at that point in time, manufacturing was 25 to 27% of the gross national product, and finance was only 10 to 12. And now you jump ahead to the 2000s, and you've got finances up at 20 to 21%, and manufacturing has slipped back to 12%. We are a nation now that moves money around, and in some ways, the biggest part of the financial sector is the debt and credit industry.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's mortgage or it's credit cards or it's all the brokerage firms or all the people that behind the scenes come up with all these, I won't call them crazy, but they're certainly pretty precarious securitized instruments.
Mm-hmm. And so basically, you know, what does America make? America makes debt. So that's the shift toward the financial sector. And as you point out, we now gear our economy, the still the largest economy, single country economy in the world, to what is a very volatile sector.
It's not only a volatile sector. Historically, it's been a sunset sector. In other words, countries that have built things and grown things and caught things and produced things, as they develop a global supremacy, turn more towards the fruits of that supremacy, which is finance and financial services and commercial relationships and so forth. And what generally happens, and oversimplifying, but what generally happens is they overreach in terms of global commitment, too many troops, too much hubris, too much imperialism. And to pay for it all requires more and more debt. And the United States in the last 40 years has just increased the debt burden at the same time as, for one reason or another, the average family has most of the time stagnated in terms of income and had to start borrowing. And debt has ballooned pretty much at the same pace that people have either felt they needed to borrow or they borrowed in order to be able to consume more. And those are both troubling dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was the blip when during the Clinton years, I mean, he actually left the White House with a net surplus, not erasing the national debt over time, but a surplus. Yet that didn't really change the movement of things, did it? In other words, the long-term trends that you're talking about.
No, because there's an unfortunate dynamic to this. The reason that he was able to get the budget deficit down is that the tech stock boom and the larger financial boom that underlay it produced so much of an inflow of capital gains tax receipts that it was enough to bring the deficit down. The difficulty was that another part of this boom involved a massive increase in private debt, mostly financial debt, but also mortgage borrowing, which is household borrowing. And this became then the next bubble. After the tech bubble collapsed in 2000, Clinton was still president. By 2001, Alan Greenspan, seeing that you were having a pretty bad implosion in the stock market, decided to gin up the real estate side. And basically what they did is they orchestrated a second bubble. So, yes, I think that the Clinton administration, certainly without designing it that way, became part of a sequential bubbling of the American economy and part of the transfer of power away from the old sectors, especially manufacturing to finance. Finance flourished under Clinton.
Right. And that covers, we've gone through 1, 2, 3, 4 is the quadrupling of U.S. Debt between 87 and 2007. And then we come to dishonesty, incompetence, and quantitative negligence. You have been, you write in this book, and you've been talking about it in your interviews, about cooking the books. And I think this, again, is something that will be, people should know it, but I think it's going to be news to a lot of people. What do you mean? How have we been cooking the books in terms of information in this country on finances?
Well, it's a multi-tiered problem. You've had cooking the books in the most simple way in terms of federal economic statistics. I have some of this in the book, but I did a big story that's the cover story in Harper's this month on what they call, entitled, the numbers racket. And it's talking about the consumer price index, unemployment numbers, and gross domestic product numbers. And to make a long story short, that's where you can argue there's been a lot of cooking in the most obvious sense. And one of the people who was quoted in there is Barack Obama's principal economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, who said that the Bush administration cooked the books in terms of minimizing unemployment early in this decade. You've also had an enormous amount of gamesmanship coming out of the financial sector in terms of all these things that Americans have just started to understand that have come into existence, all kinds of exotic derivatives, derivative instruments, things like mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations. These things are all trillion-dollar experiments, and the experiments haven't done very well. And that's the problem. They put this stuff out without understanding how it was going to work. The federal government, especially the Federal Reserve Board, went along. Greenspan would not regulate it. So all of this stuff builds this new bubble, and it's worse in terms of the implosion that's coming than we had with Enron and some of the games that came out of the late 1990s bubble.
Okay, I want to talk specifically about a couple of things you just mentioned there. Let me amplify them and see if I've got this right. One of the things that goes in that is a result of that cooking of the books, in other words, when we start changing the way that we define the consumer price index and the cost of living and so on, that actually hurts people who are either on pension, Social Security, and so on that have things gauged to the cost of living. So it isn't just a number. It actually affects people's lives.
Well, it's very significant. You've got, first of all, I think a growing belief that instead of 2 to 4%, the inflation rate is certainly 5% and probably somewhere in the 6 to 9%. Now, if you take that, the ripple effects of having done that for 10, 15 years, this gamesmanship, Social Security payments should be a lot higher. Pensions should be a lot higher. Cost of living increases should have been much bigger. So an awful lot of people are paying the price for that. A lot of retirees are paying a second price in that because inflation was sort of faked into a lower echelon than it really was, you had lower interest rates. Now, that was very good for the people in the financial sector because that enabled them to get money at very low rates and then invested in all kinds of gimmicks. But at the same time, you had people in Sun City, Arizona, or Southern California, Florida, retirees who were getting peanuts on their CDs. And when you favor the financial sector with low rates, you tend to disfavor savers and especially retirees who get peanuts in terms of interest, when in fact the inflation rate is a lot higher. So the seniors are being clobbered about three ways to Christmas.
Right. What about the numbers that they won't even tell us anymore? That the M3. What's going on there? Again, this is something that you're not going to find except maybe on page 30 of a newspaper.
Well, M3 is something that's very significant. We used to, until 2006, had three versions of calculations of the money supply. M1, that was very simple and didn't go too much beyond currency and its equivalents. M2, which was a bit bigger in terms of picking up bank CDs and so forth. And then M3, which began to get into the loans and levels of debt and credit coming out of banks. Now, M3, they decided that they wouldn't publish after early 2006. And if you just look at M1 and M2, which don't reflect anything very much of gaming in the financial system, you don't have a huge growth in the money supply, or you haven't most of the time. But M3 started really soaring in 2006.
And that's when they stopped telling us about it.
Yes, and that's right, exactly. And at this point now, it's clear that we have a much broader-based inflation. But in order to pretend that that wasn't the case, it was a lot easier if you didn't have M3 coming out in 2007 showing 12-14% year-over-year growth.
So yeah, as you said,
this is almost fraud statistically.
That's what I'm saying. In other words, as soon as it started diverging from the other two, they just stopped giving it. What did they tell people, and why have... I mean, one of the questions that always comes up in this kind of an interview, Kevin, is why has everyone stood for it? Why isn't there, either from the media, from economists, from the Democrats, from sound-thinking Republicans, why isn't there more of an uproar?
Well, the media have trouble describing it because they'd have to get into lengthy descriptions of how these things have been slowly but surely modified. The CPI is probably the easiest to explain if somebody wants to, but the consequences of explaining it become very difficult. Secondly, neither of the political parties has totally clean hands here. If you go back and look at what happened under which administration, more happened under Republicans, but that was partly because they were in office for more time.
Right.
You had some of this under Bill Clinton, and you had rising inflation, which just left Jimmy Carter in the 1970s sort of stunned. So it's not that the Democrats have been as much involved, but they don't have clean hands, especially if you're somebody like Hillary Clinton, who was there when a lot of these things were changed in the late 1990s.
Right. Okay. How about, and this is, again, I think going to be new to a lot of people, this is Terry McNally talking to Kevin Phillips about bad money. How about the way that... this is one that I don't think we have the complete information on, but about the Fed sort of putting its own hand on the scale, that there's a working group that was created that perhaps deals in the stock market when it needs to. Talk about that.
Yes, this is the president's working group on the financial markets, and it was set up in 1988 after the 1987 very brief stock market crash. And there's some thought, and I believe it, that the Federal Reserve Board actually intervened in this period by buying Standard & Poor's futures, stock market futures, and supported the market that way. Well, what they did in 1988 is they set up the president's working group, and you didn't hear very much about it, but there were a couple of stories that gave it serious attention, that it had a war room and that it had files with the names of everybody who counted in finance around the world, and that it held sort of fire drills and everything like that. Recently, there's been more speculation in 2001, right after 9/11, and then in the last year and a half, that they were back in action again, and that they were very conspicuously intervening at certain points, and that reports of this intervention were coming from people in the commodity futures and financial futures pits, and there were a lot of reports. A number of the financial publications have touched on this at least once, but they have not in any concerted way tried to analyze what's coming down here. And I think that the probability is that you have a clandestine, I can't call it secret because people know that it's there, but what it does is not discussed. And if I were one of the senators running the Senate Finance Committee or in the House side, House Financial Services, I'd have them in, and so, I'd ask them about this.
So for people, again, let me get this straight. The Fed has a group that it seems, when it feels the need to throw some money at the markets to affect the way a day or a week will end up looking. Is that really what is going on?
And it's not just the Fed.
Oh, okay.
No, the president's working group singles out two people for prominence, and others are sort of floating. And the two are the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, at this point in time, 2007, 2008, it's clear that the more important mover is Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary. Bernanke is a lesser figure. Certainly in the Washington power structure, Paulson is much heavier. So what you have is a close cooperation and I'm sure discussion between the Treasury Secretary and the Fed Chairman, and they don't have to have it while they're sitting in the meeting room of the President's working group. They can have it some other place. But I think what you have seen over the last 20 years intermittently is that these two power centers in government, Treasury and the Federal Reserve, have probably intervened in the markets, always to the benefit of the financial sector, and kept market forces from operating. So we have, in essence, sort of loaded dice.
Yeah. In other words, certainly anyone who listens to my show knows that we constantly point out that what's called market capitalism or the free market is not, that it's fudged here, it's fudged there. But this was a new fudge that was news to me. Let me ask you, because you do deal about it in some length in the book, and then I want to leave time for one big question at the end. How does oil fit into this?
Well, oil is a very central component of what's circling the United States. I think of it as six or seven sharks in the water, and one of them is financialization. The second is the huge amount of debt. Third is the global commodity inflation. Fourth, home prices collapsing. But fifth, you have a very important aspect of oil, which in turn relates to the dollar. The United States was the major oil power in the world from, the decades after the Civil War up to the 1970s. And oil was central to Allied victory in World Wars I and II, and central to America's industrial triumph, even to the laying out of America's transportation system and then residential complex. And since the 1970s, we've started to lose control over oil. The first stage was when OPEC got its price increase in the early 1970s, and Nixon and Kissinger at that time cut a deal that in return for the increase, and it was a very small early increase in oil relative to the incredible numbers we have now, that what the OPEC powers, principally Saudi Arabia, agreed to do was that oil would be priced, bought and sold globally in dollars, and that the OPEC members, especially the Saudis, would recycle their petrodollars, their profits, and put them back in the United States in the form of buying treasury debt, and that would reinforce the dollar. Now, this worked, I suppose, reasonably well up until a period right before the invasion of Iraq, but a lot of the oil producers saw the invasion of Iraq as having a secondary motive, try to get a hold of all of Iraq's oil and dump it on the market to bring the price down. Didn't work. It boomeranged. The price went up 500% in the 5 years after the war. And OPEC is disgusted with the United States and doesn't believe what the people in charge say. And as a result, they have let the price ratchet up. And as the price goes up, oil has become a drag on the dollar as opposed to a prop for the dollar, and
right.
that's producing a major problem here.
Right, and in fact, people are now jumping ship. Countries are jumping ship and no longer exchanging in dollars. I don't think I have time for one question that I'm going to leave out there. If we have time at the end, I'm going to ask you to come back to it, which, as you just referred to it, the invasion of Iraq. How does the invasion and occupation of Iraq and our bloated defense budget affect our financial standing? Lave that one aside, because I want to ask a bigger question.
Okay.
What does it mean, and this is what I observe, that greed and cleverness have led leaders and significant players in the corporate sphere, we saw it with Enron, WorldCom, Adelphi, et cetera, where they were doing things off the books, they were creating dummy companies, and the accounting companies that were supposed to be watching them were not. Then we look at the government and defense spheres. We have a war started on false pretenses. We have a war funded through emergency supplemental, so neither Congress nor the military has to deal with real accountability on the money they're spending. And now we see the financial sphere in this credit crisis, basically a lot of similarities. Moody's and those who are rating the bonds don't really know what they're rating, so no one is really watching. The players, the financial players, are creating instruments that are created perhaps solely because they escape regulation, and we now see. So what I'm saying is corporate, financial, government, military, at the leadership at the top levels of all of these powerful players are dealing in greed, cleverness, and deceit. What does that say about us as a country and our leadership?
Well, unfortunately, if you go back in American history, you see elements of this before. You certainly could have seen it in the Civil War when the greed in supplying the troops was unbelievable. Other examples. But having said that, I think that the combination here is especially powerful because a lot of it ties into the question of financialization. That's a major problem for the government because they've lost control over elements of the economy and the budget, and they like to fake things. The corporate people are so tied into finance because they get their money out of bonuses and they worry about their stock price much more than what they produce. And the long and the short is that the dishonesty that's emerged in the financial sector has emerged at the same time as first the financial sector has become the dominant component of the economy, and secondly the financial sector has escaped regulation because it's typical when you have a new emerging sector. We saw this
right.
with railroads
right.
and manufacturing
okay.
100 years ago, that they escaped regulation. It's
okay.
I've got to get it back on.
I've got to go. The book is Bad Money. The website is bad-money.com. Thank you, Kevin Phillips. Keep up the good work.